Thank you very much. We're rather beholden to technology tonight. Can you all hear at the back from the roving mic? Thanks very much. The same image is going to be on both screens, so you won't need to pretend you're in a railway carriage trying to look out at both sides at the same time. As Andrew mentioned, we're going to be looking at Let's Trade in the Great War tonight, obviously, and I'll be following the passage of the war from 1914 through to the end. We'll be looking at Let's Trade immediately before the Great War, the situation in Europe immediately prior to the war. Then we'll go into 1914 to 1916. Then we'll return briefly to have a look at the home front here in Lechlade. Then we go back to the battlefields for 1917 to 1918, and then commemoration at home and locally and nationally. And we'll be condensing the entire First World War into 85 minutes with about 160 pictures and maps and so on. And then at the end, be happy to take questions. Now, one of the best sources for information on Lechlade or a lot of communities before the Great War was Kelly's directory. And I think we're pretty familiar with the fact that Lechlade had a station on the East Gloucestershire line coming down from Witney, the cattle sale in the market square, and the population then about 1,100 people, so a little less than half the present day population. Sporting activities, there was a football team, and this photograph was provided by Bernard Sparks, and on closer examination it provides us with pictures of two of the people on the war memorial. We found very few photographs of Lechlade's people on the memorial, but here we've got two who served in the Royal Engineers, and we'll come across their stories later on. During the course of the talk, it's impossible to cover all the people on the memorial and the others we've subsequently found with a Lechlade connection. But we've dotted through quite a few that should add particular interest as we go along. There's also a swimming club, which was the secretary's William Sands, who also ran the football team, and that's the gala down by Hickney Bridge. And there's also a swimming pavilion on the north bank, and the chap in the circle, Roland Innocent, is a name that should be very familiar to people in Lechlade, and he was a 1918 casualty who actually was a bit tricky to track down, believe it or not. There was water produced from a number of wells, including up where Kingsmead now is, and the electricity plant in Sherburn Street, now long gone. The post office was pretty well staffed, and the lady in the middle in the furs, in her 60s at the time this picture was taken, Sarah Sadler, we'll come back to you later, because she again caused us one or two difficulties. Already in 1914, we know that the Scouts were in operation in Lechlade, which means that next year will be our centenary. And in April 1916, Lord Baden-Powell himself came down to inspect Lechlade and Bribery Scouts. In terms of some of the personalities in Lechlade as we approach the Great War, the vicar was the Reverend Robert Brownrigg, and you probably know that his son was the Lieutenant Commander on HMS Hood when it was sunk on the 24th of May, 41, in the Denmark Strait. Station master of the Great Western Railway was George Wilmot, and we'll encounter his son in Egypt a little bit later on. The parish clerk, seen here, John Phipp, a postman, member of a distinguished Lechlade family, who contributed a lot to the church. This is Sarah Sadler herself. The vet, John Baxter, that's a long line of Baxter vets in Lechlade. And the constable, P.C. Stafford, a little mystery about him. He features in 1915, and we're pretty sure he's connected to a soldier by the name of Stafford on the memorial. Moving away from Lechlade to Europe, the powers in Europe didn't particularly have an appetite for war as 1913, 1914 approached. But Austria-Hungary was a little bit concerned about what was going on in the Balkans, where there'd been unrest for quite some time, and in particular with Serbia. Britain and Germany were engaged in an arms race, which we won by a country mile, or as it was all to do with warships, maybe we won it by a nautical mile. Germany was particularly interested in expanding its fleet because it wanted to have colonies around the globe. Not that there's much left of the world to carve up amongst the powers. I have heard it said that when Queen Victoria made Kaiser Wilhelm an honorary admiral in the Royal Navy, That's when he decided he wanted some ships to go with it. In Germany, they were keeping a watchful eye on what was going on in Austria, Austria-Hungary, and in Russia. And in Germany itself, there was the rise of socialism, which was obviously of concern to the German authorities. And in France, there was still a lot of animosity between politicians and commanders of the armed forces, stemming from the Dreyfus affair. Dreyfus, you probably remember, was a Frenchman but came from the Alsace region, and he was accused of spying for the Germans and was subsequently sent to Devil's Island but was pardoned and brought back to France. But nevertheless, the bad taste lingered on. The sight of troops in Letchade certainly wasn't unfamiliar to locals. This is large-scale army manoeuvres in 1909. The Red Army, which is a shocking choice when you think what happened 50 years later, was based in Burford. And the other clue that this is 1909 is the unfinished building on the corner just by the bank, which if you look on it, it's got a plaque built in 1909. So the cavalry and the infantry, for example, there's a battalion of the Cheshires and the East Yorks and the Worcesters, and here they are in the market square. But significantly, and also the river was obviously very handy for the engineers to practice building bridges across a river. Significantly, and I include this picture because Sir John French, who was Inspector General of the Army, came down from Aldershot to Letchade to observe the manoeuvres. And here he is on his horse in St. John's Street talking to the Duke of Connaught. And he was to be the commander of the British Expeditionary Force as Field Marshal Sir John French in 1914. And that included a number of Letchade men, as we will see. You'll also note between the horse and the car, there's a French officer who was over here observing the manoeuvres, as was practice in those days. As we move into 1914, Austria, as I mentioned, was getting quite concerned about Serbia and some of the activity going on there. And in June 1914, they got their 15th and 16th Army Corps to go and have their summer manoeuvres in and around Sarajevo. And Archduke Ferdinand came down by train to Sarajevo to see his troops during their manoeuvres. And on the way to the town hall in Sarajevo, somebody threw a bomb which exploded but didn't injure him. But later in the day, as you know, he was assassinated along with his wife. Now, the Balkans have been a hotbed of activity for quite some time. Back in the First Balkan War in 1912, the Serbs have been instrumental in helping to get rid of Turkey from the Balkans. But Russia was quite keen on uniting all the Slav states as part of Russia. And Germany was watching what was going on, but they also had an eye on France. Unfortunately, when Belgium being created, Britain had guaranteed Belgium's neutrality. So if Germany was to invade France through Belgium, as was suspected, then Britain would be bound to support France and Belgium. Also, whereas Britain had been aligned to Germany going back a couple of decades, through the Entente Cordiale, we were now much more aligned to France. And as things turned out, Germany, after the assassination and Austria declared war on Serbia, and Germany mobilised, Britain sent an ultimatum to Germany, and that was set at midnight Berlin time, which is 7 p.m. our time, 4th of August 1914. And then, because Germany didn't respond accordingly, the British forces were mobilised. Though coincidentally, just a few weeks before, the British 2nd Division, based in Aldershot, where their memorial is on Gun Hill, had already had a practice mobilisation, just a few weeks before. So the British Army was certainly ready, and there was a well-planned process for sending out telegrams to individuals and post offices and police stations and so on to get everybody to return to barracks. So the Germans entered Luxembourg and Belgium, and the British Expeditionary Force was made ready to go to France. Now the key part at this stage of the war was the Schlieffen Plan, which was for the Germans to come through Luxembourg, Belgium, swing round to the left and circle Paris and knock France out of the war. Now, the number of Lecce men, regular soldiers and reservists, who went with the British Expeditionary Force to France, and the first significant contact was at the rather dismal Belgian coal mining town of Mons. And the British were able to temporarily stem the German advance, but gradually had to fall back. The next significant action was at Le Cateau, which again is just a small village, really, just to the south. And they fell back right until they came down to the River Marne. And see how close they are to Paris on the bottom left of the map. And then the Germans were pushed back and the line settled up on the River Aisne, just to the north. So apart from this activity, the other significant fighting in 1914 was the First Battle of Ypres, which was a whole series of minor actions stemming the German advance towards the Belgian coast. And Ypres became a really key point on the Western Front, as we'll see. Just returning briefly to Britain, the Cotswolds were not a very good recruiting ground for the army in the First World War. But in Lechlade, there were a number of rallies, one in September 1914 when Earl Bathurst came over from Cirencester and various speeches made, including all the lurid details of alleged atrocities in Belgium. And then the volunteers were told that the following day they'd be taken by bus to Cirencester. Already at this stage of the war, there had been four Lechlade casualties, three of whom were on the war memorial. And there's one or two bits of information as we go through that, if you're doing your own family history, might be quite useful. All these have four-figure army numbers, which is a sure sign that they were either regular soldiers or that they were reservists called back to the colours. William Mayo was badly wounded as the British Army fell back to the Marne. And he died on the 14th of September, 1914. He's buried in a cemetery over towards St. Quentin, which was actually behind the German lines for most of the war, but the cemetery was well maintained, and his grave remains today. First of all, Brogdon was wounded up at Ypres during the first Ypres, and he was evacuated all the way back to one of the newly established base hospitals on the French coast at Saint-Nazaire, where the raid was in the Second World War. To deny Germans use of the port there. And he died of wounds on the 22nd of November 1914, and he's buried in the cemetery at Saint-Nazaire. Charles Pettifer and William Norton were both killed in action in the fighting on the Marne, but their graves were lost. And this introduces us the bodies were not recovered, introduces us to another aspect of the Great War, and that's the memorials to the missing. And later on, the numbers get pretty big. This is quite a small one. When the grave registration units were created, and then the Imperial War Graves Commission, it was established that every soldier would be given an individual grave with a headstone with his details on, or be commemorated on a memorial to the missing. And this is one at La Ferte on the Marne, which commemorates the missing from the actions from Mons down to the Marne in 1914. So by November 1914, the front line had been really stabilised from the Belgian coast at Nieuport down across the wet Flanders plain, as Henry Williamson called it in his novels, past Ypres, up over a big clay ridge called Messines Ridge, down to Armentières on the French-Belgian border, where Mademoiselle came from, across the Loos battlefield, has become, which is a coal mining area, down to Arras, which is quite a large provincial town. Just north of there, the big chalk escarpment that the Germans held called Vimy Ridge, more of that later on. Down across the Somme battlefield, and then it swung round towards Soissons, Verdun, and down just inside the German territory to the Swiss border. So Lechlade men had been quite heavily involved in these early stages. Moving on to 1915, the main actions then were in the Dardanelles, where Churchill came up with a scheme to force the Dardanelles and enable the Navy to threaten Constantinople and knock Turkey out of the war. The Ottoman Empire at the time, of course, came right down into Palestine. Second Battle of Ypres, which was significant because on the 23rd of April 1915, that's when the Germans used poison gas for the first time, and the line was largely held by the Canadians. And then the Battle of Loos, which we'll come to in just a moment. The names for 1915 grow a bit, as you'd expect, with more men being drawn into the military operations, and because casualties were quite high. And you'll note as well that there's a soldier from the New Zealand military forces here, which is an indication of legislative men who had emigrated before the war and settled in the Dominions, joined their forces and came back. And we'll look at him in just a moment. First soldier that we'll use to illustrate the process of the war is Albert Hatton, who lived at times in Lechlade and in Southrop, and his daughter Margaret Hatton lived locally until she died in 2010, I think it was. Albert Hatton had served with the Wiltshires in the Boer War, but it must have been 2nd Battalion because the 1st Battalion were in Hong Kong. And we're pretty sure, that's not terribly clear, he's wearing the Queen's South Africa Medal with several clasps. He, before the war, had gone to get work in South Wales as a miner, and he was called back to join his regiment. And he was killed in a minor operation on Messines Ridge. Oh, sorry, he's wounded in a minor operation on Messines Ridge, where his battalion were attempting to get a hold on the German line, but they were repulsed with quite heavy losses. He was hit in the chest by either shrapnel or a bullet, and he was evacuated back to a hospital in Cardiff. And there he died and was brought back to Southrop, where he's buried in the churchyard. He died on the 25th of March 1915. And that's an example of a very small-scale operation that achieved nothing but incurred quite a lot of casualties. He's also commemorated on the Southrop War Memorial. Now, Gallipoli was the operation designed to try and get Turkey out of the war. And there were four theatres: Suvla Bay, where the landings were in August 1915, Anzac and Cape Helles on the 25th of April 1915, and then the French over on the Asia shore. But apart from the French, the British, the Australians, New Zealand, there were also Newfoundlanders there as well. Edmund Lewis was serving with the Wellington Regiment. He'd left Lechlade some time before the Great War. We're not sure when. And he was a farmer on the North Island. And in October 1914, he joined the Wellington Regiment and served with them to Egypt and then across to Lemnos on the Aegean. And then on the 25th of April 1915, the first day of the landings, he landed on the shores of Gallipoli with his regiment. And in May, part of them were brought down to the Cape Helles sector. And this is the picture of the Wellingtons in their bivouacs. And in late May, there was random Turkish shelling, and Edmund Lewis was killed. And originally he did have a grave, but like so many on the Gallipoli Peninsula, they were lost. And he's commemorated on the memorial at the back here, which is the 12-tree Cops New Zealand Memorial at Gallipoli, which has 180 names on it. And you'll notice here in the cemetery, instead of the conventional headstones, they've got these grave markers. And there's 3,360 burials in the cemetery, of which 2,200 are unknown soldiers. He's also commemorated in the churchyard. If you go out to the end by the school, on his parents' grave, it recalls their son, the youngest son, who was killed in action at Gallipoli, brackets Turkey, May 1915, while serving with the New Zealand forces. And we were quite pleased to find that, because he was a bit of a problem to pin down originally. And then this photo came to light, and circled is a poster advertising the liners going, in this case, to Canada. And this must have been an influence on Lechlade men who went to places like New Zealand, Canada, and no doubt Australia and South Africa. Our next man, Charles Stratford, was serving with the 16th Lancers. Now, although that's a cavalry regiment, they were serving as dismounted troops in the Ypres salient, just to the east of Ypres, near a place called Poti Chateau, which by that stage of the war was just a pile of bricks. Now, each unit on active service had to maintain a war diary, which is a daily record of what they were up to. Some of these are extremely good. Some of them aren't worth the paper they're written on. Some mention people by name, particularly officers. Some mention other ranks by name. But occasionally, there's other clues as well. In the case of the 16th Lancers, on the 19th of May, 1915, it records that the Lancers moved back to a wood by the chateau, leaving a few men in each squadron in the trenches. They also sent out parties to assist the Royal Engineers. One man was killed, and the only casualty that day that fits is Charles Stratford, so that must refer to him. But he's got no known grave, and he's commemorated on another memorial to the missing, which is the one at Menin Gate. Now, Ypres was a Flanders woolen town with long-standing trade with England, a fortified town designed by Vauban, and the Menin Gate on the east side of the town, would thousands of troops would have come in and out of there on the way to and from the salient. So it's entirely fitting that the memorial to the missing of the Ypres salient up to the 15th of August 1917 should be positioned here. And the walls inside are and outside are covered with the names of the missing. Now, William Sands, we saw earlier, he joined up quite early in the war, joined 95th Field Company Royal Engineers, and was over in France fairly quickly. This is a chap in the suit. And he lived down here in this house in the churchyard, by the churchyard. And he was killed in the Battle of the Luce. Now, this area, if it wasn't for the First World War, there'd be no reason to go there at all. It's a bit like a Frenchman electing to go to Barnsley or Rotherham. You know, you just don't do it. But three Lechlade men were casualties in quite a small area. William Sands was engaged on the night of the 25th, 26th of September 1915, bringing guns in from the battlefield. But the war diary doesn't say much more than that, but he's probably killed by enemy shelling or rifle fire, machine gun fire, and he's got no known grave. Just to the west, was a thing called the Double Crassier, which was a large spoil heap from the mines. And the original ones aren't quite there. There's two in a similar position these days, so you can get a good feel for them. They're much larger these days. And in 1916, Urban Williams was there with the Battalion of the Gloucesters, and their war diary just records that during the period they were in the line, there have been 20 men killed, one of whom was Urban Williams. And he's on our war memorial. He's also on the East Leach war memorial. He's a resident of Lechlade. And then the day before Sands was killed, James Barrett, serving with the Wiltshires, is a Lechlade man, was wounded. And he was evacuated a short distance away to a casualty clearing station, which we'll come to in a moment. Now, William Sands is also commemorated on a memorial to the missing, another one we come to. We pick most of them off on the Western Front. This is the Luce Memorial, and the names are on the walls all the way around the cemetery here. And this is the same place where the Queen Mother's brother is commemorated, and where Rudyard Kipling's son was until they found some remains that allegedly were his. Barrett was brought back to a hamlet near Baytoun, where number one casualty clearing station was based for most of the war. And these casualty clearing stations dealt with huge numbers of casualties coming through, and obviously a lot of them died of wounds. And he is one of those who died of wounds and is buried in the cemetery here. There's also an airfield nearby, and there's a number of Royal Flying Corps burials here as well. And you see it's maintained to the standards that the War Graves Commission set and continue to achieve all around the world to this day. Charles Wilmot was volunteered in quite early in the war, and he was the son of the station master, and the Great Western Railway produced some large paper war memorials after the war, and there's a few left around. Taunton Station, Paddington Station have got one, and I think Severn Valley have got one, and he's listed on there. He left Avonmouth in June 1915 with the Battalion of the Gloucesters, 7th Gloucesters, and he served in Gallipoli from July until October 1915. But he was evacuated, as so many troops were, from the peninsula with illness. And he's brought back here to Alexandria, where he died of dysentery on the 23rd of October 1915. And he's buried here in the cemetery. He's also one of five Lecce men commemorated on the family grave, in either in the churchyard or the cemetery. And this one recalls their son, Charles Ernest, who died for his country in Alexandria, Egypt. I mentioned Bernard Sparks earlier. I remember the Sparks family presented us with quite an interesting outcome to this research. He lived here at number 5 Oak Street, just up from the butchers. And he was another one serving in a Royal Engineers field company. And when we went to visit where he was buried, this row of headstones caught our eye. And that's a pretty firm sign that all the people in that grave died in the same event, same situation. And the war diary for the Royal Engineers is extremely useful. They were in Armentières at the time, and it records that the billets where the men were heavily shelled by the Germans, and 2 shells fell into the officers' billet, 2 into the other ranks' billet. And the 45 casualties, of whom 9 were killed, 36 were wounded, and 2 more died in the coming days. And these burials took place at 4 p.m. on the 13th of November. So we know the precise circumstances and the time of the burial of Maurice Sparks, and this is his grave with the Royal Engineers badge and his details. So not everybody was killed in action in you know, huge attacks. There were all sorts of circumstances, and Maurice Sparks was certainly one of those who were serving his country, and probably would have carried. I'm sure he would have carried on to the end had it not been for that unfortunate incident. Now, 1916, there's a big sort of gear change because the Allies are getting their act together. Up until then, the war had been singularly unsuccessful. And the strategy for 1916 was a joint Anglo-French offensive on a large scale on the Somme, where the French and the British joined. Unfortunately, the Germans preempted this by attacking at Verdun, and they kept on drawing more and more French forces in to that particular battle. So it fell to Britain to maintain offensive operation in 1916. And the Battle of the Somme, starting on the 1st of July, was that action. And there also, the idea was to capture a large chunk of German-occupied territory on the first day, but that certainly didn't succeed. And so there are a lot of subsidiary operations, and we'll see a couple of those involving Lecce men. There were people from the village serving in Mesopotamia, but none of them were casualties, so we won't dwell on places like Kut and Basra and places like that. Very briefly, the front line on the 1st of July was the black line coming down on the left-hand side of the map. And the idea was to take virtually everything else on that map on day one. But for a variety of reasons, only a small part of the German line was taken. And over the coming months, until the 14th of November, 143 days later, they were sort of biting away at the German line, sustaining huge losses against a very good, very, very good German army. So inevitably, the names on the Lecce Memorial increase because more men involved, huge battles, on a massive scale. But not all of these were killed on the Somme, far from it. And a few more here. The first one that we'll look at from 1916, a slightly intriguing story. About 25 years ago, I got involved in researching these German soldiers who are buried in a churchyard in Tarrant Monkton down near Blandford Forum in Dorset. And then when we came to research the Lechlade men, and I hasten to add, none of the Lechlade men were in the German army, lo and behold, there's a Lechlade man buried right next to them. And this is Frank Moss, from a Lechlade family that lost 3 sons in the Great War. And he was in camp in Blandford Forum, and he contracted pneumonia, and he died on the 11th of April, 1916. But he's buried in the churchyard there, rather than being brought back to Lechlade, which is slightly intriguing. So he died without going overseas, as did Ernest Woodward. We know very little about him. He's on the memorial here. He gets a mention in the parish magazine. He was serving with Royal Garrison Artillery, who manned the very big guns, and he was based down in Sussex, and he died in Brighton, and he's buried in Brighton Borough Cemetery. But we, as I say, we don't know any more about him. This was August 1916. We then go across to Egypt for another casualty. Frederick Stevens had served on Gallipoli from the 21st of August 1915 and come out of that. Came back to Suez with his unit, and their war diary is quite useful. They're engaged on road repairs at the time, and it says that the 20th of April, one man belonging to this company died of an operation. So having survived Gallipoli, he died of appendicitis in Suez, and he's buried in Suez War Memorial Cemetery. We saw earlier Edmund Lewis had gone to Canada. There were others like Alfred Sparks who went to Canada as well. Samuel Sowden was the son of, his parents lived in, and he lived until he went away, number 11 Thames Street. And he was a grocer in Regina in Canada. He joined in October 1914 and came over to the United Kingdom and then across to Belgium. The Canadians were in Belgium quite early in the war. And on the 6th of June 1916, his battalion were at a place called Hooge on the Menin Road, just to the east of Ypres. Even today, Hooge is about two houses and a cowshed. But it was quite an important point on the front line, defending Ypres from the Germans. And this introduces us to another aspect of the war, and that's military mining. It was common practice, going back hundreds of years, to use explosive charges to dislodge the enemy. And all the armies on the Western Front used to tunnel under opposing lines in certain places, plant large explosive charges and blow them. And on the 6th of June 1916, the Germans blew four mines at 3:30 in the afternoon beneath the Canadians. And Sowden was in A Company, and the war diary records that A Company was virtually annihilated. So it's not at all surprising that he has got no known grave, and he's also on the Menin Gate in Ypres. I mentioned the subsidiary operations on the Somme. The Germans had fortified a number of villages along the front line, and of course when they'd been destroyed by the gunfire, they were even easier to create machine gun posts and all the rest of it. And George Hoare was a Lechlade man, and he was involved in an attack on the village of Blauwassel. And if that name's familiar to you, then it's probably because of Loch Na Garr crater, which is just up the road from the village. This was blown at 7:20 on the 1st of July 1916 to enable troops to advance and take the lip of the crater and get hold on the German front line. Obviously, destroy the German front line and the troops holding it, although the Germans held their front line quite lightly. And you can still go and see the crater to this day. There's a good account, if you remember the Royal Flying Corps, who was flying nearby at the time when it exploded. And you're probably familiar with the film of the 1st of July 1916 of a huge mine crater blowing up. That's just up the road from here at Hawthorne Ridge, but exactly the same principle. Anyway, George Hoare was with the 8th Gloucesters attacking the village of Blauwassel, an attack that started at 3:15 in the morning. And his battalion suffered 66 casualties, and he was one of them. And he's got no known grave. And through Maureen's efforts, we were able to get hold of the photograph memorial card and one or two other bits associated with George Hoare. Now, because he's got no known grave, he's also commemorated on the Memorial to the Missing. And this is the one at Thiep Val, designed by Lutyens, the well-known architect. Jet valve was a German strong point, and so there's a certain good reason for it to be put here, I guess. And there's a small French and British cemetery there as well. But there's two other Lechstade men on here, Albert Constable and William Hartley. The latter, of course, was quite a problem to us, which we'll come back to. Albert Constable was with the 10th Gloucesters, and his battalion was engaged in another one of these minor operations to capture a village, in this case Bazentin-le-Petit. And they captured the village on the 17th, 18th of August. But he was killed in action. Again, he's got no known grave. And he's one of 1,060 members of the Gloucestershire Regiment on the Tiet Val Memorial, which is roughly the equivalent of a whole battalion. Now, he lived in Sherburn Street, and before he went to war, he was already married, and he had three daughters, and one of them was still alive when we did the original research for the book in 1998. William Hartley, on the Moor, William Saddle Hartley, we just couldn't trace a Lechstade connection here until we were going through the magazines one day, and it turned out that he used to come down here to stay with his grandmother, who was Sarah Sadler, the postmistress. Now, the criteria for people being on war memorials varies immensely, and you do get situations where people are on six or seven war memorials. And he was killed on the last day of the Somme offensive, the 14th of November 1916, serving with 7th Royal Fusiliers. And he's also on this war memorial, 140 miles away, up in Lancashire. Now, the next cluster of Lechstade men, bizarrely, occurred within a few days in the nursery sector at Armentières. Quite often, when battalions and divisions were brought to the Western Front, they were posted up here because it was a fairly quiet sector. It's about a few miles southwest of Lille, before you get up into the Ypres salient and north of the Loos battlefield. Percy Godwin was the first casualty, and his battalion war diary is extremely good because it actually mentions him by name, which for another rank is quite unusual. Because the main operation in July 1916 was down on the Somme, divisions up in this area were required to undertake smaller scale offensive action to make the Germans think that something was going on up there, and stop them sending guns and men down to the Somme to the main battle. And Percy Godwin's battalion, the 4th Gloucesters and 61st South Midland Division, undertook a raid on the German lines, which was very well documented. They, according to the war diary, they left the trenches at 12:40 a.m. 1:20 a.m. they entered the German trench, despite a lot of machine gun fire and rifle fire. The officer leading the attack, a Captain Hannam, was wounded. But they, according to the diary, they killed 15 to 20 Germans. Then it records that they had to withdraw. And amongst the men that they left behind was a Sergeant Hyde, a Private Cox, a Private Franklin, and a Private Godwin. And their fate was unknown. So it's really quite something to from our point of view, to come across some other ranks mentioned by name. The German division holding the line at the time was the 6th Bavarian Reserve Division. It was a very good division, been there since about March 1915. Even in the intelligence reports in 1918, they're still classed as a good division. Whether they buried the men of the Gloucesters who had been killed or just disposed of them over the back of the trench, we don't know. But he's got no known grave, and he's on the Pozières Memorial to the Missing, which will come to you later on in 1918 again. And the names are on the under the colonnade at the back here, and the Gloucesters are just here. Now, earlier we saw... we think Charles Godwin is his brother, and he was killed much later in the war, serving with the 2nd 6th Gloucesters. Certainly a Lechstade family, but both Charles Godwin and Percy Godwin were born in Bristol, and Charles Godwin's widow certainly had a Bristol address after the Great War. Now, he was killed on the 15th of December 1917 when the war was becoming a bit more mobile, and he's buried right over towards the sort of Canal du Nord area in a place called 15 Ravine British Cemetery. And the war diary records that the troops that day were, quote, lightly shelled, which is a slightly cryptic description when you've got high explosive landing around you, or shrapnel. The second casualty who was at this time was Arthur Beak. Now, he had left Lechlade in 1901 and gone over to Twigworth, north of Gloucester, to be a farmer. And he had his foot blown off by a German shell on the 4th of July 1916. And at the same time, there's a reference in the war diary to Jonah Pass, who died in 1919, being wounded as well, but Jonah Pass stayed in France. The evacuation of casualties from the battlefield was extremely good, and casualties could be back in hospital in Britain within 24 hours. And Arthur Beak was in France for 2 weeks, then he was brought back to the Eastern General Hospital, which at the time was here at Pembroke College, Cambridge, until they went over to Boulogne a bit later in the war. Unfortunately, he didn't recover from his wound, and he died in October 1916, the 8th of October 1916, and he's buried in Cambridge Borough Cemetery, Cambridge City Cemetery on the Newmarket Road. And like a lot of cemeteries where there were hospitals in British towns and cities, there is a war graves plot. And this one, unusually, also has the names on the memorial here. He's also commemorated on the memorial at Twigworth, and that's the same churchyard where the poet Ivor Gurney is buried. Now, Sidney Walker was one of the soldiers that we stumbled across once more material was available on the internet. The original research predated the web. He was serving with the 12th East Yorks, who were in the 31st Division. And they'd had a terrible time down on the Somme in July 1916. So they'd been brought back up north of the La Bassée Canal, up towards Laventie, where the divisional HQ was. And he was died of wounds on the 19th of July 1916, just close to where there was quite a large-scale operation, which is subject to one of my books, involving the 61st Division and the 5th Australian Division. And he is buried in another quite interesting cemetery near Laventie, where there's a British plot here. And on the other side of the lane is the graves of men of the Indian Army who have been very active around here in 1914. And just beyond down here, there's a British concrete blockhouse. And this land was given in perpetuity for the cemeteries by the French government to the British government. But often they're in farmyards, fields, and so on. And generally the farmers do respect them. Occasionally you find a footpath that's been ploughed, but generally they are well respected. Another name we came across quite recently, Walter Toswell. His parents lived down near the garden centre. But we think he's not on the Lecce War Memorial because after the war, when the memorials were being compiled, they moved over to just beyond Cheltenham. He was only 22, and he was a regular soldier serving the 1st East Lancs, and he was wounded with his battalion just outside Ypres. And he was brought back to a town just to the west of Ypres called Poppering, where Talbot House, Toc H, was created. And he died of wounds where there were a number of very large hospitals. And Leytonhook Cemetery, Military Cemetery, is fairly typical of these large cemeteries in the area with some 10,000 graves. The reason why they're there is because there were railway lines that could then evacuate troops back to the coast and back to the United Kingdom, as well as obviously bringing men and material back in. But he is commemorated on the memorial. Quite a nice one in the church at Wolston over near Winchcombe. The last day of the Somme, 14th of November 1916, this little boy here, Thomas King, by that time was serving with the Royal Barks. His family lived over near the Trout, but they farmed, although they worked on a farm over near Buskett. He joined the Royal Barks, and he was engaged in an operation on the 13th, 14th of November, attacking a part of the German line that the British called Frankfurt Trench. And unfortunately, he was killed, but his body was recovered. And Frankfurt Trench Cemetery, as it was later called, is located on the German front line. And so you can see the names of these cemeteries come from many different sources. Some are named after individuals, some after German positions, some after units, and so on. Just looking briefly at the home front, quite early in the war, there was something called the War Supply Depot set up by Mrs. Brownrigg, the wife of the vicar, and Mrs. Jones from the manor. And obviously, apart from supporting the war effort, these are quite good social gatherings as well. But they worked pretty hard. And when the war depot was closed down in October 1917, they'd sent away 4,500 articles to people like the Red Cross and soldiers overseas. So things like socks, gloves, hats, dressings, and something that the Parish Magazine called an anti-vermin vest. I bet they didn't work very well. But another feature of the home front was two families from Belgians, the refugees, arrived here in 1914, one from Ostend, one from Ypres. And there was a Belgian relief committee set up under the chairmanship of Bentley Innocent, the auctioneer. And the number of very good fundraising activities, for example, the farmers in 1915 raised £450 for the war effort. And there was another, later on in the war, £54 was raised for prisoners of war, including, I think it's £5, 1 shilling and sixpence by the scouts doing some entertainment. The Belgian refugees returned to France in late 1914, and the following year the Belgian committee was closed down. So it was a very good work done by the people of the village to support the war effort. But the other feature, which had nothing to do really with the war, unless the German saboteurs operating in Lechlade, was the fire that broke out on the 10th of January 1915. And the alarm was raised by P.C. Stafford, who we touched on earlier. And they went to the fire station next to Wrighton House, and the fire engine had been dismantled for parts to be overhauled and sent away. So P.C. Stafford organised a car to go to Fairford to bring their appliance back, by which time the street was well alight. And it burned right through to the following morning. And there are some pictures of the damage, which was quite serious. And it was realised there was no telephone in the police station, no telephone in the fire station, and there was only one hydrant in Lechlade. And although there had been a scheme approved before the war to install a load of others. And as you see, the local paper commented on it being a very unpleasant experience, such as the oldest inhabitant of Lechlade cannot recollect, which I'm sure it was. You'll be aware of, in the Second World War, of the Home Guard and locally the Upper Thames Patrol. Well, there was a local defence volunteer group formed here by a chap called Captain Metcalfe, who became involved in the War Memorial Committee later on, after the war. And these guys look as though they're old soldiers, plus a gamekeeper in one of the rear ranks. There's also a younger section. Now, we're not sure where this picture was taken. If anybody recognises it, then we'd like to know. But it's a fairly distinctive gateway. And one or two suggestions were made in 1998 when we showed the picture. And I sort of cycle around the countryside, but I can't pinpoint it. But in the front row is the brother of Roland Innocent, serving with this unit. So returning to the battlefields, 1917, things are looking much more positive, with operations that are much better planned and executed. There are certainly Lechlade men in Palestine pushing the Turks back, and Jerusalem was taken at Christmas 1917, and then there were things like cavalry charge at Beersheba, the action at Gaza, and so on. In Salonika, there was a multinational force, which we'll come to in a moment, and there's certainly Lechlade men there. Arras was the operation started Easter 1917, and we'll look at Vimy Ridge, that huge chalk escarpment, in a moment. Messines Ridge was a superb operation when at least one Lecce man was killed. Third Ypres was the collective name given to sort of taking chunks out of the German line as we moved towards Passchendaele. Then Cambrai, where the tanks were used in very large numbers. And the names increase again in 1917. Not all of them died abroad. Sidney Wheeler, for example, was a Lecce man, but his wife had moved down to Maesteg in South Wales, and when he died in the UK, he was buried down in Maesteg. A few others as well. The Arras operations. Arras, so a reasonable sized provincial town, and two points of note here. Vimy Ridge is just north of Arras, and there's a big operation to dislodge the Germans from there. When the Germans advanced in 1914, they tended to stop on the high ground, and Vimy Ridge is a good example of that. The other thing they were doing in the area was building the Hindenburg Line, which was back from the front line. Resources were getting quite difficult for the Germans. They're still waiting for more divisions to come from Russia. And eventually they did fall back to the Hindenburg Line. And obviously that was a very challenging obstacle for the British Army to break through. Now, although Vimy Ridge is often regarded as a Canadian action, British divisions were involved, and British artillery was. And Lecce man Daniel Bolton was serving with the Royal Horse Artillery. And again, we see a cluster of graves here. Now, their war diary doesn't appear to have survived. But it's very likely that the four men in the battery were either killed by counter-battery fire from the Germans, or they had a premature explosion in the breech or the barrel of their gun. And he's buried in a little cemetery called Bois Carré, just on the south side of Vimy Ridge. And if you go there today, there's the Canadian memorial to the missing here, with the Spirit of Canada weeping for her dead. And just in the background is the loose battlefield. You see the spoil heaps, which are more or less where the Double Crassier was, where Urban Williams was killed, although these are much larger than the Double Crassier. To the west, it overlooked what was the British lines, and to the east, looked across the German lines, across the plain of Douai. So it was really quite a vital piece of land to capture. And it's now a Canadian memorial park, and you can go down some of the tunnels there, and the lost battlefield is sort of pockmarked with shell craters as it was left after the war. Now, Salonika, Turkey was, and Bulgarian forces were threatening northern Greece, so the British and French and others were in Salonika. And this was also the theatre of war where Stanley Spencer, the artist, was serving with the Royal Army Medical Corps. And some of you may have seen some of his pictures, which were all based on his experience here in the Salonika Theatre. Victor Cooper was born in Lechlade, but he enlisted in Swindon quite early in the war. And he was with the 7th Wiltshires, who had gone out to Salonika. Now, they sustained most of their casualties in two particular periods of activity. But the majority of casualties from Salonika were actually a result of disease and illness. And on the 24th, 25th of April 1917, the Wiltshires were in action. They lost 324 men, one of whom was Victor Cooper. And he's got no known grave, and he's commemorated on another of the memorials for the missing at Doran in Salonika. He's also one of the five mentioned on the family gravestone in Lechlade, where it says Victor George, killed in Salonika April 24th, 1917, aged 24 years, and also records his brother who died in Egypt in 1918, and we'll come to him in a moment. Now, Messines Ridge, 7th of June 1917, is a really interesting action. The planning had started in 1916, and the Royal Engineers dug galleries under the German line through the clay, and they planted 21 massive explosive charges beneath the German lines, up to 60,000 pounds of ammonol. And the plan was to blow them all at the start of the attack to disrupt the German defences. And in the early hours on the 7th of June, the 19 of the mines were blown. And amongst the men taking part in the infantry assault was Frank Williams. He was born in Kempsford, but came to live in Lechlade, and he had, I think it's four brothers and two sisters. One brother was serving with the Royal Flying Corps. And this is his wife, Irene, who died in childbirth in May 1913. And he ran a bike shop where Stacey's place is now. And his family didn't want him to go away to the war, but he did join up. He joined originally the Bedfordshire Regiment, and then he was transferred to the 14th Battalion Royal Irish Rifles, and 16th Division. And he was attacking on the 7th of June in exactly the same place where Albert Hatton had been wounded in March 1915. Now, when these mines were blown, they certainly did the job they were designed to do. But because they're on clay, when you go and visit them nowadays, they're full of water, whereas on the Somme, where it's chalk, they're dry. But the war diary is extremely detailed up until the time of the attack, just after 3 a.m., and then it becomes a bit scant after that. But he was killed taking the German line, and his body was recovered and brought back to a place called Lone Tree Cemetery, just on the opposite side of the road from that crater that we saw. And as you can see from the War Graves Commission sign, the cemeteries all across the Messines Ridge in that area, which is a pretty good sign of the intensity of the fighting. This is the entrance to the cemetery, and on the skyline you can just see the spire of Messines Church, which at the time was held by the Germans. And this is his grave. The 14th Royal Irish Rifles were, or the Royal Irish Rifles were actually quite cute by giving the prefix 14 stroke whatever on a soldier, which makes identifying the units much, much easier. Now, Passchendaele, that, if you ask anybody on the street to name something to do with the First World War, then Passchendaele might come out. It was a series of operations to improve the British defensive position around Ypres to keep the Germans away from the coast. And after Messines, there were a number of other operations through the autumn of 1917 in dreadful weather conditions. And also, the area is very low-lying and relied on drainage ditches. Of course, these were destroyed by shell fire, and that's why you see the First World War pictures of soldiers up to their neck in mud. And one of the casualties from Lechlade was Frederick White, who was born in Great Tew in Oxfordshire, but they're living in Station Road in Lechlade. And after the war, his widow worked in Redlands, which is a big house in Highworth as you go down the hill, just on the left-hand side, downhill towards Swindon. He'd originally served in the Gloucesters and then the Worcesters, but by 1917 he was with the Somerset Light Infantry. And they were engaged in an attack on the 15th, 16th of August 1917 on the village of Langemark. Now, in 1914, a number of German infantry battalions had been slaughtered at Langemark by the very proficient British riflemen, the old Contemptibles. And there's a huge German cemetery there with a mass grave with 44,000 burials in it. And Langemark Day is not quite the equivalent of Remembrance Day in Germany, but it's certainly part of their commemoration of the Great War. 7th Somerset Light Infantry were attacking Langemark on a front 400 yards wide, and they advanced a mile and a half, which by First World War standards is pretty good going. And somewhere in that area of land, Frederick White was killed. He's got no known grave. And he's commemorated here at Tyne Cot. Now, this area was actually captured by the 3rd Australian Division on the 4th of October, 1917. And the name was given by the Northumberland Fusiliers because they thought that some of the remaining farm buildings in the area looked like cottages in Northumberland, presumably without the shell fire damage. And the huge cemetery and memorial to the missing was created here. The names are on these colonnades. There's some circular areas, and then on the front as you go out and overlook the cemetery. And the Cross of Sacrifice is built on one of the German blockhouses. And if you stand out there, you can see just on the skyline the spires of the churches in Ypres. And I've walked from here to Ypres in an hour and a half. And that's what the British Army was fighting over from 1914 to 1917. So just to give a bit of a feel for it, this crudely is the Ypres salient. You've got Ypres, bottom left, Passchendaele, top right. To give you a feel geographically, if we created a Lechlade salient, and we imagine that the front line came to a stand in Wharf Lane in 1914, by October 1917, we'd be on the point of retaking Bampton in Oxfordshire. That's the scale of the area that accounted for thousands of casualties in the British, Canadian, French, German army. Unfortunately, if any of you live in Filkins, you've still got Saxon troops living in your houses, I'm afraid. Another term that you come across in accounts of the First World War is just the daily wastage, which sounds terribly dismissive of men who had volunteered to serve their country. George Clayton Hicks lived in Clayton House, which is just opposite where the co-op is now, and you can just read the name on the gatepost. He's an example of this daily wastage. The South Wales Borderers were moving stores to the Royal Engineers up on the Menin Road, and they were shelled throughout the day by German gunners, and he was one of a number of men killed, and he's buried here in a place called Burr Crossroads Cemetery, which is named by the 1st Battalion of the Leinsters after their depot in Ireland. But he's also remembered on the family gravestone. This is the family grave. As you go out of the churchyard here into Wharf Lane, it's just on the right-hand side. And if you look carefully, you can just read the inscription commemorating their youngest son, who was killed in Belgium, August 26, 1917, aged 20. Now, a particularly interesting casualty was Harry Barrett, who was serving with 53rd Field Ambulance of the Royal Army Medical Corps. The Germans were extremely good with concrete on the Western Front, and most of it's still there to this day. When these German blockhouses were captured, they provided useful shelter for things like dressing stations or signalers or whatever. But unfortunately, Germans knew where they were, so their artillery had the range of them perfectly. And also, it meant that the doorways were now facing the Germans. And on the 20th of November 1917, Harry Barrett and the 53rd Field Ambulance were using Cement House, which is then this blockhouse, as a dressing station. He was in here. And about 10 p.m., a German gas shell landed in that green doorway that we saw and blew away the gas curtain that was put there to try and keep gas out. And 20 men from that were in the blockhouse were overcome by the gas fumes. And they were evacuated back to Wimmera on the coast near Boulogne. And the farmer kindly let us have a look in there to get a bit of feel for the conditions. Unfortunately, he died on the 22nd of November 1917, and he's buried in Wimmera Communal Cemetery, which is a particularly interesting one because the unstable ground requires the headstone to be laid flat on the ground. And there's three like this on the Western Front. There's here, Mill Road on the Somme near the Tietvale Memorial, and just up the road at Boulogne, Eastern Cemetery. And this is his headstone with the Royal Army Medical Corps badge on it. He was certainly an Lechlade man and joined up in 1915. But he's in quite good company in the cemetery because quite close to him is the grave of John McCrae from the Canadian Medical Service, who wrote the famous poem in Flanders Fields, Poppies Blow, etc. So if you go and visit Harry Barrett's grave, then go and see John McCrae's grave. But unfortunately, like a lot of the kind of celebrity burial places on the Western Front, if I can use that term, there's usually quite a lot of wreaths and the grass is usually dead around the headstone. So it'll be quite easy to find. Now, the Cornbray in 1917, this was an operation involving tanks, which had been a British innovation on the Western Front. The Germans never really got into armoured warfare in the First World War, but they made up for it in the Second World War. There were about 400 tanks used at Cornbray with great effect, but the Germans were a good army and they were very good at counter-attacking. And a lot of the gains were lost before the battle petered out. And a couple of lettres laid men, Charles Florey, had been out in France since, originally went out there in 1914. And was living in Lettres when the war broke out, but for some reason he enlisted in Birmingham, which probably explains why he's in the Warwicks. And he was killed during the German counterattacks on the 3rd of December 1917. Again, he's got no known grave. He's on the Cornbray Memorial. There's another Lettres man in this area, but from 1918. Frederick Carter lived here in West End Villa, which is opposite Tom Warner's Field. And he was serving with the 1st 7th Lancashire Fusiliers, who had served at Gallipoli, but I'm pretty sure that he joined them once they arrived in France in 1916. He was killed very late on as the British Army was pushing the Germans back on the Hindenburg Line. And he was killed on the 27th of September 1918, so very close to the end. Again, he's got no known grave, and he's on another memorial to the missing at Vaison-en-Artois. And the names are on the walls behind behind the columns. Now, by 1918, you think that it would have been pretty plain sailing for the British and the French, but the Germans had been able to release a lot of men and guns from the Russian front there, the Eastern Front, and they really had their last chance to break through to the Channel ports and knock the Allies out of the war. The war operations down on the Aisne, but as far as the British were involved down there, but on the Somme region, there was the German spring offensive, which everybody knew was coming, but nobody knew quite where, nobody knew quite when. And there's some superb accounts of the sort of tension around the 20th, 21st of March, in expectation of the German attack. The Italian front, there were British divisions out there, and we'll have a look at the Lecce casualty in Italy. And then we get on to the last 100 days, which the British government weren't going to commemorate in 2018, until they changed their minds, and then ultimately the armistice on the 11th of November. Very briefly, the German spring offensive came around St. Quentin and Peron, and it was actually a very well conducted operation, which pushed the British right back to almost to the town of Amiens, which is a very large town, important railhead for the British, big cathedral town. The British Fifth Army were in this area, and they bore the brunt of it, and there were subsequent operations further north on the Lys, for example, and in Belgium. But Lettres men, there were four who became casualties in the spring offensive, and we'll have a look at them. In terms of 1918, there were a number of others, and we'll look at several of these soldiers, some of whom are on the memorial, one or two we found subsequently. The first one there, William Lappington, lived in Lechlade, but he was a farmer nearby. And he had originally served in the Army Service Corps, in the Hampshire Regiment, before transferring to the 1st Dorsets. And he was serving in the line close to Langemark, where Frederick White had been killed. And the battalion next to them, the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, sustained a very heavy German assault. And the battalion of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry and the Dorsets helped to repulse the Germans. And the 1st Dorsets recalled that two other ranks were killed. So it was Lappington and one other. And they're buried in the cemetery at Pole Capel, next to each other. And somebody, with an interest in the grave, has penciled in the letters on the headstone, which is not a good thing to do. Percy Cooper was in the front line with the 8th Royal Barks on the 21st of March. And the German attack was launched in the early hours of the morning in thick fog. And there's a number of accounts of very, very severe hand-to-hand fighting, particularly around some redoubts the British had created. And we found a couple of clues that indicate that Percy Cooper was killed on the 21st of March as the Germans moved forward in large numbers at some speed. But his record in the War Graves Commission I think actually it says 21st to 26th of March 1918. There's quite a lot of uncertainty about precise operations at this time. You look at war diaries, and they're quite brief, or a few days later there's a summary of that period. And he's another Lecce man on the Pozières Memorial. Now, he lived in Lecce, he was born in Lechlade, and his family was still living here, but in 1914 he was actually living down at Kintbury on the Kennet-Avon Canal, and that's where he was living when went to join up. And apart from being on our memorial, he's also on the memorial in the church and the churchyard in Kintbury. It's like Urban Williams and one or two others, he's in more than one place. Now, George Moulding had been out there since 1914. He was related to John Onion on our memorial, who was killed with the 57th Machine Gun Company up in Belgium. I put him in because there's an excellent book on German string offences called Kaiser's Battle by a guy called Martin Middlebrook. And in there, he gives an account of the Wiltshires at a railway junction called Achiette-le-Grand, just north of Bapaume. And there's an incident there where a shell landed on a hut occupied by a number of sergeants of the 1st Wiltshires. I think 9 of them were killed or wounded. And it seems pretty certain that George Moulding was one of those. And he was evacuated not far away, probably, I suspect, died of wounds. And he's buried in this cemetery at Poucheville, which is not too far up the road. Now, Andrew Smith was a real problem, because Andrew Smith isn't his name. When you look at memorials and records of the war, you do see Private John Smith served as Private Fred Bloggs. But his name was actually Frederick Andrew Smith. And he was a Lecce man. He lived in Sherbourne Street up by the Baptist Chapel. And he had previously served in the Army Service Corps. But by 1918, he was with the King's Liverpools. Now, this was a very fluid time of movement on the Western Front, and his battalion had been up fairly close to where the Tietvale Memorial is now. They come down the hill to the River Ancre, pursued by the Germans, and on Station Road here at Beaumont Hamel with a number of other battalions, they were overwhelmed by the Germans, and he was killed somewhere close to Beaumont Hamel Station. And again, he's got no known grave. And he's on the Arras Memorial to the Missing, which covers, amongst other theatres, many of the men of the 5th Army from March 1918. I'll also point out the column in the middle with the globe on top is the memorial to the missing of the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Air Force. But as with a lot of the memorials to the missing, there are graves there, and there's a Lecce man buried here. William Turner lived in St John Street. And his father was killed in the Boer War in South Africa. And his mother subsequently remarried, and her surname, when he was killed, was Mrs. Painter. He was serving with the 2nd Essex, and appears he was wounded somewhere over towards Monchy, to the east of Arras, brought back to Arras where he died of wounds. On the, was it 2nd of September 1918, so another very late casualty. William Stafford, we suspect, is related to P.C. Stafford, but by the time the war graves cemetery registers were compiled and the families could contribute an inscription, the parents' address is given as Winchcombe. He was wounded a few miles northwest of Bapaume and brought to what was a large field hospital here just to the southeast of Arras. And if you go there today, there's this very nice cemetery in the middle of acres of rolling countryside. But if you go back to 1918, on the other side of the road there was a railway line, so there would have been hospital trains in there, no doubt, and then fields would have been full of tents and marquees and huts of the military hospital. But unfortunately, he died of wounds and on the 27th of May 1918, and he's buried here just by the side of the road. Now, Roland Innocent is probably the best known of, I suspect, the Lecce casualties. We found this picture of him on the diving board by the river. Family lived in Sherburn House. He was educated at Shaftesbury Grammar School, and from his number, we know he joined the Royal Flying Corps in October, November 1917. And here he is in officer cadet uniform of the Royal Flying Corps. He was based for a while at North Camp, which is the dismal end of Aldershot, for those of you who know it, and later down at Hastings. But the Royal Flying Corps had expanded greatly because they thought they're going to have to provide a lot of airfields for the advance into Germany. So they had to disperse a lot of their surplus men, and he was transferred to the London Regiment. And if you look at there's a book called Soldiers Died for each regiment, and there's a lot in there that say previously Royal Flying Corps, and Ronan Innocent is one of them. Now, his battalion were on an attack well to the east of Arras on the 1st of September 1918. A very successful attack, but after the battle, Ronan Innocent was posted as missing. And on the 1st of October, the family received Army Form B-104, which said that he was missing in action, but it did go on to say that he may have been separated from his unit, or he may possibly be a prisoner of war. Anyway, nothing more was heard, and then in March 1919, the family received another letter saying that he was missing in action, presumed killed, or died of wounds on the 1st of September 1918. But it wasn't until 1925 that his body was found on the battlefield. And even today you still find the bodies of the remains of soldiers on the battlefield. It's probably a French farmer ploughing, or maybe rooting around in an old dugout, or filling in a trench. And the remains were found and identified and buried in this cemetery. And the family donated the altar rails behind us, and there's this brass plaque fixed to the wall, to the south wall, in his memory. Samuel Moss was another of the three Moss brothers who was killed. By this stage, the advance was, we're looking at October 1918, we're getting quite close to the end of the war, and the 1st Gloucesters were pushing out patrols towards a place called the Swanborough Canal, which was being used by the Germans as a defensive position. And during the day, the war diary records that the four other ranks were wounded, and Samuel Moss, it appears, was one of them. There are no casualties either side of that, and he's buried here at Badencourt. So getting very close to the end of the war. Now, on the Italian front, the Italians suffered a couple of reverses against the Austrians on the Piave and the Asiago Plateau. And George Pierce, who was born in Farringdon, lived in Lechlade until the Great War, but he travelled to Reading to enlist and end up in the Worcesters. He was sent out with his division to northern Italy, to the same area where Edward Britton, the brother of Vera Britton, who wrote Testament of Youth, was killed. And I put this one in because he died of wounds on the 15th of June 1918. The Italian cemeteries are quite different because of the high mountain area where the British fought. And in the winter, the headstones are completely buried in snow. Another casualty who died on the 11th of November 1918 was one we found a number of references in the Parish Magazine, which is an extremely useful source of information. We're very fortunate to be able to see them. Frederick Horn was serving with the 1st Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers who were in Malta before the war. Generally, each regiment had two regular battalions, one at home, one overseas. The Royal Welsh Fusiliers, 1st Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers, were in Malta. The 2nd Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers may have come across because Robert Graves was in that battalion, and he wrote quite a good account of his service, a very good account of his service with the battalion. Anyway, the Parish Magazine records that in October 1914, Frederick Horn was in France, and a very bizarre entry, says he was wounded. He was shot through the knee, not seriously. Anyway, he obviously survived, And in August 1916, he was on the Somme with his battalion, and he was hit in the back by either a rifle bullet or machine gun bullet or a piece of shrapnel, and was paralysed. And he was brought back to hospital in London. He was discharged from the army in March 1917. And then he was transferred to hospital in Oxford, and he died in hospital in Oxford on 11th of November 1918. And he's buried in grave 43 in the cemetery, just there by one of my early research assistants. And the town council supported us in approaching the War Graves Commission to have a headstone put up, which, according to the terms of the War Graves Commission, the charter, he was entitled to that headstone. It's possible, of course, he may have requested his grave wasn't marked, but there's quite an exhaustive search made, and this headstone was put up a few years ago. Now, Reginald Cooper, we came across him earlier with the football team and his brother Victor Cooper. By December 1918, he must have been looking forward to coming back home to the United Kingdom. And he'd served at Gallipoli, served at Salonika. But on the 22nd of December 1918, his unit were in camp at Mina near the pyramid just outside Cairo. And he died, presumably of illness. The war diary makes no reference to his death. And so on the point of coming home, he died, and he's buried here in Cairo. I suspect sometimes on the 11th of November or Remembrance Sunday, people wonder why we've got a 1919 casualty on here. Surely the war had finished. Now, Jonah Pass, who was wounded in 1916, was still out in France and Belgium later in the war, and serving with the 2nd and 5th Gloucesters and 61st Division. He was the son of the gamekeeper at the manor, and they lived in a cottage that's now part of Sunflower Cottage just by Little London. His brothers were serving in the Cheshire Police, and before the war he was a blacksmith, but he had the ambition to join the police as well. But he went off to war, and in October 19... 17, his battalion were engaged in an offensive operation against the Germans, and after, when they returned to billets behind the line, he was missing, and it turned out that he'd been captured by the Germans, although the Gloucesters also took about 20 German prisoners as well. So he was taken back to Germany, and a short time later his battalion came out of the line and they went to Italy. After the war, well, the POWs in Germany in the First World War probably had a much worse time than those in the Second World War. And at the end of the war, he came back home, or came back to Cheltenham. But he had TB, and he apparently was in very poor health indeed. And he died on the 2nd of March 1919. But for some reason, his headstone in Presbury Cemetery says 3rd of March 1919. We found a few other prisoners of war amongst lecture aid men. The bottom one I'll mention in particular, Sidney Darville, was a very well-heeled man from Wrexham, and he married one of the daughters of the Joneses at the manor. And they actually had a son who was killed in Italy in 1943, who's not on our memorial, but his name from this year was read out. And the other interesting thing about him, he was a Welsh international footballer. So dare I say it, the sort of Gareth Bale of his day. Another casualty who, from natural aid, Arthur Beckinsale, who lived in natural aid before the war and up until the time he joined up, not on the war memorial for some reason, also died on the 11th of November 1918, the day of the armistice. But he's buried in Cologne Southern Cemetery. We haven't been able to establish when he was taken prisoner. It can be very difficult to work out. But the Red Cross records in Geneva are currently being digitised, and before long we'll be able to go and look at POW records and find out when he was taken prisoner. But the fact he's buried in Cologne Southern Cemetery, he was a POW, and probably again died of ill health, you know, through the conditions that they experienced in Germany. So with the war finished, there was an inevitable celebration parade in Lechstadt, here outside the New Inn. And the village and the nation looked to ways of commemorating the dead of the Great War. And there's a war memorial committee formed in 1919. And at the time, the Memorial Hall belonged to the Joneses at the Manor, and they handed it over to the village in 1919. And subsequently, about 1995, it was sold. And of course, we have the current Memorial Hall. Also, in the old Memorial Hall, we found a reference to five framed scrolls listing 230 men from Lechlade who had served in the Great War. But we were hoping that they've long since disappeared, but hoping when the Jubilee Hall Antiques took over and refurbished the place, they might have turned up, but they didn't. We've been able to identify 170 men from the village who did serve in the Great War. Now, the various ideas put forward for memorials in Lechlade, some were quite good, some were a little bit odd. And the War Memorial Committee decided to have a tablet on the north wall in church. And they got a guy called William Glasby from Fulham to design it. Now, he was a very well-known, very capable stained glass artist. Unfortunately, skills at designing war memorials weren't terribly good. But the design that was put forward and was accepted were the names, more or less in date order, in year blocks. And round the edge, the emblems, like the thistle and rose and so on, of the countries in the British Isles. It cost £150 to design and erect, and was put up in, unveiled in August 1920. And the vicar makes a very interesting reference in the Parish Magazine. He said that whilst it may be an attractive enhancement to the church, they were very disappointed that the names can barely be read. And they consulted the people who knew about war memorials, and they said that under no circumstances were the letters to be blacked in, because over time the letters would become clearer. But that hasn't happened. And then with the water, you know, with the leak in the roof many years ago, frankly, it isn't one of the best war memorials around. But nevertheless, it does fulfills its function of commemorating some of the men of Lechlade who died during the war. And then, if you ever wondered about the wooden bench underneath, that was given in the 20s by Walter Jones from the Manor. It's an oak bench. Nationally, there were various medals awarded, depending on when you served, where you served, the theatres of war, and so on. So the old Contemptibles would have had the 1914 style, which looked a little bit like the red, white, and blue ribbon, but with a clasp on to indicate they're old Contemptibles. Then there's the 1415 star, the middle, the British War Medal, then the Victory Medal with a ribbon that was used by all the Allies. And these were sent out in the early 1920s. And this picture in 29, you see quite a lot of the veterans wearing their medals. We also discovered a number of Lechlade men in different theatres of war who had won gallantry medals. And there's a bit of research to be done on this. But George King, for example, won the Distinguished Conduct Medal, which these days you call a second tier award below the VC, in Palestine, which in 1918 was pretty good, because they did start reducing the numbers in 1917, because it came with a pension. Now, obviously, it's getting a bit expensive rewarding people for their gallantry. Very, very well deserved medal. Now, wounded men who were discharged faced the wrath of women with white feathers. So, there was an initiative to enable them to wear an emblem, which was called the Silver War Badge, on their clothing, civilian clothing. And Frederick Horn was a recipient of two of these. Possibly the first one was mislaid. And they all have a unique number on the back, so you can see who the recipient was. There's also a memorial scroll issued with the royal cipher and the inscription there, and handwritten entry on the bottom with the name, rank, and regiment, or unit, of the recipient. And this is George Hawes, who, remember, was killed on the Somme in 1916. There's also a memorial plaque issued. There's competition to design something of this nature. And the guy called Edward Carter Preston, who designed this, designed a number of other war medals right through to the Korean War Medal. It weighs 8.5 ounces. It's bronze. Around the edge is the inscription, "He died for freedom an honour, or if it's a woman, she died. It's got emblems of the British Empire on it, then a small panel with the name of the recipient, and it doesn't give their regiment or their rank or their number. And if they've got an unusual name, you can generally pin down who it is. If it's something like John Smith or something like that, it can be a real problem where there's multiple casualties of the same name. And these are two Tolecce men, there's Victor Cooper and George Hoare. The original batch were made in a foundry in Woolwich in southeast London, and later at a foundry in Acton in West London, and you can tell the difference if you look very carefully. And finally, I guess in the form of commemoration, an unintended way, in 1964, the BBC created a superb series called The Great War, when historians such as John Terrain came to public notice. And I understand it's going to be repeated next year. And the opening episode and the opening scenes are typical English countryside rural locations. And it includes that one there. So when it comes on next year and you think, oh, I recognise that, then yes, you do. So through that, through the hopefully the book we produced in 98 and our service on Remembrance Sunday every Sunday morning, I hope that these men and the others from Lecce who gave their life in the Great War are remembered. So thank you very much for listening.